Welcome to the Asbury First United Methodist Church Weekly Sermon. We hope you enjoyed this message. For more information about this podcast or other ways to connect, please visit asburyfirst.org.
So nobody liked Moses. I know that sounds harsh, but it's also kind of true. I suppose his father-in-law Jethro probably liked Moses since he took care of his sheep. But let's be honest, nobody really liked Moses. He wasn't especially charismatic or charming or trustworthy or well-connected. And up until this point, a lot of what he has done is questionable. You might remember that Moses was the one Hebrew boy that was saved from genocidal drowning. Pharaoh had commanded that all the boys born to the Hebrews must be thrown into the Nile. So Moses' mother did exactly that. Just before she did, she waterproofed a basket and put the baby in it and hid it in the reeds where the daughter of Pharaoh came to bathe. Moses' sister waited nearby so that when the baby was discovered, she could intervene. Pharaoh's daughter found the baby and just couldn't bring herself to throw him into the Nile. If you go back and you read the whole thing, you'll find that a whole host of women were involved in protecting the Hebrew children from Pharaoh, including Pharaoh's own daughter, who adopts this baby. Not because he was special or anything, it was all because of the subversive courage of several women. So Miriam, Moses' sister, intervenes. She says, "Would you like me to go get a Hebrew nurse for this child?" And Pharaoh's daughter says, "Yes." And so Miriam goes and gets their mother. And Pharaoh's daughter says, "I'll pay you a salary to take this child home and take care of him." I kind of want to unpack that. But I'm only sharing this part here to get to where we're going. When Moses is weaned, since he's Pharaoh's daughter's adopted son, he gets to go live in the palace with a royal family, where he grows up a Hebrew, but also the grandson to the Egyptian king. For some context, the Hebrews were living in Egypt, but the conditions were absolutely horrible. Besides the genocide, there was also harsh slavery. So Moses was a Hebrew, but living in the palace with the chief oppressor and wearing fine clothes and eating fine food all off the backs of his kinfolk made him less than popular with the Hebrews. So Moses starts to recognize this dissonance as a young man, and he goes for a walk where he encounters an Egyptian beating a Hebrew. And so he intervenes. Now, this part of the story is essentially Moses using his privilege to swoop in and save the day. When he thinks no one is looking, he kills the Egyptian and hides the body. But Moses can't get away with murder. And now, not only do people not really like him, they want him out of their lives. The Hebrews are mad. "Who does this man think he is?" they ask. "Who died and made him king?" The Egyptians are mad, and Pharaoh is really mad. And we don't hear about how all of those women who saved his life and fed him and raised him feel, but we can imagine that they weren't very happy either. And Moses, in fear and in shame, runs away to Midian. And this is where we find Moses this morning. He's watching Jethro's sheep out in the wilderness on Mount Horeb. Fun fact, Mount Horeb is also called Mount Sinai. Have you heard of that? He's getting some solid resume experience shepherding a flock in the wilderness on God's holy mountain. The problem is, that's not how most people see it. Moses is a guy without a lot of leadership potential. He is unpopular, and he hasn't earned anything on his own. He is good at taking care of sheep, but he's terrible at public speaking. He's impatient, he's angry, and he's violent. And Moses doesn't think much of himself either. He's not like offering himself up for any leadership roles. In fact, the discourse between God and Moses goes on for a lot longer than you might expect. Long after the end of today's reading, Moses pushes back again and again, indicating his anxiety about taking this on. I mean, would you want to? If you had made a huge mistake and then ran away to avoid dealing with the consequences, how would you feel about God showing up and saying, "Now, I'd really like you to go back and convince a lot of people who don't trust you to come back here with you"? I imagine that Moses, who the scriptures present as avoidant, angry, anxious, afraid, was probably dealing with shame, burning shame. You know that feeling of shame. It really does feel like burning, doesn't it? Like your insides are getting hot. Like you might melt from it. It shows up when our mistakes are pointed out, or when people treat us badly, or when we treat other people badly, or when we're alienated or estranged from someone or a group, and then we have to interact with them. You know that thing that you did that was really embarrassing, and how you feel with the people who were there? You know that thing that happened to you that was really embarrassing, and how you feel with the people that were there? We deal with burning shame a lot by avoiding it, running away from the people or the places associated with it. Or we get angry and the heat inside burns and we think, "How dare you point out my mistake? I'm a good person." Or we get anxious, like we feel like we're going to melt on the spot and never make it past this moment. Or we get afraid. We think, "Am I really as bad as I feel like I am right now?" If we pan out further, we take a look at the whole Hebrew people. We find them laboring in oppression, enslaved by the Egyptians. If a person or a people are consistently told that they're not good enough, consistently treated like they are not good enough, it doesn't take long to internalize that as a core belief. Oppression leads to shame. Abuse leads to shame. And so I don't think it is unreasonable to look and see on this holy mountain God's presence with Moses and the Hebrew people. The bush was burning, but it was not consumed. The bush was burning, but it was not consumed. You may not have had an experience of God's presence and call in the form of a burning bush, externally burning bush, or some external miraculous sign, but you may have experienced the reality of God's presence through the recognition that despite your mistakes and despite the mistakes that others have made with you, we are forgiven and loved and free. We may burn in our shame, but we are not consumed by it. And we are not defined by it. And in fact, we can be delivered from it. This is exactly what God has come to say. God has heard the cries of the suffering people and has come to deliver them. And Moses is going to go back to Egypt and bring the people back to that same place. But we just established, haven't we, that Moses does not embody the great leadership skills required for such a task, right? There are loads of leadership books out there. Have you read any of them? A lot of them say very similar things about needing to earn respect as a leader through showing your competency and credibility. Author Stephen Covey, son of the Stephen Covey who wrote 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, you know that one? He begins his book by explaining that he definitely didn't get his own leadership position in his dad's company because he was Stephen Covey's son, but because he proved his competency and credibility with his team. Whether that's the whole story or not, the younger Stephen Covey's book The Speed of Trust has been read by millions of leaders, and now he's a global authority on leadership. If you haven't read it, the basic principle is that organizations thrive where there is trust. That makes sense, right? When a leader lacks credibility or competency, trust erodes. When a leader doesn't trust the people working with them to make their own decisions or to solve their own problems or use their own style, they lose trust there as well. And organizations that lack trust have a lot of problems moving quickly or being effective or productive due to the cost of low trust. But if the leader builds trust in themselves while also trusting the people who work for them, it increases the organizational speed and productivity. Does that all make sense? So, obviously Moses is not the person for this job if God wants it done quickly and effectively. While Moses has competency in both escaping from Egypt and also leading a flock through the wilderness, he hasn't done either thing with actual people yet. And his credibility is non-existent. And Moses seems to be aware of this, as his first question is, who am I? Who is he? Who is he to go stand up to Pharaoh and lead the Israelites out of Egypt? This question is an echo from just a chapter earlier. Do you remember? After Moses had hidden the body of the man he had murdered, he goes to try to break up a fight between two Hebrews, and they say, "Who made you ruler and king over us?" They don't trust him. And Moses took that to heart, and he echoes that back to God. "Who am I?" And God says, "I will be with you." And Moses says, "But when they ask me who you are, what am I to say?" And God says, "I am who I am. I am," sends Moses, a God who needs no explanation, who needs no justification, who needs no validation. Can we trust that? Can we trust a God whose name is just, "I am"? Another way of translating it is, "I am who brings into being." Another way of saying it is that God speaks things into existence or creates out of nothing. Do we trust leadership from a God without a more concrete resume? We know, though, don't we, that not all people who hold leadership positions or who run for office do so because they are the most competent. And it turns out that often the people who think they would make a great president or CEO or bishop are not the people that we really want in those positions. Someone like Moses stands in stark contrast to even the least suited leaders of our time. He's not being pressured by his family or his mentors. He's not being given a leg up based on his privilege or personality. He's not even eager for responsibility. He's not looking to catch a big break, to write a book, to speak to the press, to be adored, to be a role model, to be the change. But he's going to do all of that and more, and only because God is with him. The bush is not consumed. Moses himself will become this sign for his people. His shame, his fear, his anger, his violence, his estrangement, none of this will consume him. He will return to the people, burning with the reality of their history and the hope that their history has not destroyed them. "I am" has sent him, and it is in God whom he trusts. Now, God is specific and intentional to not send a trustworthy, inspirational speaker with great leadership skills and solid training. He sends Moses, who stumbles over his words, is better with sheep than with people, and who is wanted for murder. Because otherwise, the people might put the trust in the leader and not in God. So God sends a man burning in his shame, vulnerable, into the place where his shame burns the hottest, to face the fear and to lead the Israelites to their deliverance. If Moses had trusted God right away, the conversation maybe had ended here, instead of going on for a while, with Moses needing a lot of convincing to trust God enough to go. And then if the Israelites had trusted God right away, the escape might not have been quite so devastating or terrifying or violent. It turns out that trusting in a God we cannot see for a hope we cannot imagine is a lot harder than trusting in the people we can see for the things we already know. It turns out that the speed of trusting God may take more time than we feel patient for. The Israelites' full deliverance into their own land didn't happen until they spent 40 years in the wilderness learning to trust God. After all, they were coming from a strong parent leader like Pharaoh, who knew what was best and built impressive pyramids. And learning to trust a God whose presence was a pillar of fire, who lived on a mountain and also in a tent, who brought them a long way through the desert without a map toward a fabled land that they haven't yet seen. And along the way, they complained and they fought and found trust in other things, like a golden calf, for example. And we do that even today. We can put our trust in ourselves. We can relatively, quickly, and efficiently receive the rewards that we seek: money, power, prestige. The leaders of our world may be able to offer concrete deliverables like gold and pyramids, but we can't deliver ourselves from our own guilt and shame. Our liberation, our healing, our freedom is not built by human ingenuity. It is given as a gift from the God who brings it into being. Last week, Pat shared a message about being transformed by God. He reflected on how we tend to be conformed to our surroundings and how the ways of the world don't usually reflect God's beloved community, but God can transform us throughout our lives to become more aligned with God's grace. This process of being sanctified or transformed is about being filled with love and enlightened with grace and compassion and peace. And as Pat shared, it requires us to face the things about ourselves that we might not want to face. But if we can't face them, we can never be free from them. There is no quick fix. We are not the answer to our deepest problems. Our leaders aren't the answer. The self-help books we read, also not the answer, not the real answer, not when what we need is salvation and deliverance and transformation. When we are getting too eager for speed and efficiency to make it to the promised land overnight on a nonstop flight, let us remember the people of Israel who took 40 years to learn to trust God's grace. The good news is, even if through our transformation, our shame burns hot, it will not consume us. God's grace is sufficient. We have only to trust. God is with us. Thanks be to God. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Asbury First Weekly Sermon. If you enjoyed this message, please visit asburyfirst.org and learn more about our mission to love God and neighbor, live fully, serve all, repeat.